everybody. This is Dave Caramella, and I am your host for the Philanthropist podcast. And this week's guest, we're really excited about, kind of went outside our traditional scope of talking to, you know, kind of straight up fundraisers. And we're going to talk to a not-for-profit national leader regarding homelessness and poverty and empowerment. Greg Bradbard, he's the president of Hope Through Housing Foundation. He's also the national senior vice president for strategic partnerships with the National CORE organization. Spent the past two decades as a community champion and a nonprofit leader throughout Southern California. He's you're located in the Inland Empire, is that correct? Are you in the IE?
That's right, David. Yes.
But he's a passionate advocate for moving individuals from poverty to self-efficiency. And this past year obviously has been an added challenge to an already systemic issue in the United States. So we're real excited to have Greg on as a guest. Greg, welcome. Please tell us a little bit about, you know, what's going on, what you've been doing with Hope through housing, and then even the National CORE piece, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about you as well.
Sure. Thanks, David. Yeah. So like you said, you know, National CORE and Hope Through Housing are kind of sister nonprofit organizations. Okay. And combined, our mission is to use affordable housing as a platform to elevate the health, the well-being, and the self-sufficiency of our residents. So one of the things we like to say is that, you know, this place is a launching pad, not a landing pad. And we really do try to use our housing, you know, as, you know, a tool to help our families move forward. So, you know, this this last year for us, as with everyone, has been very interesting. I'll tell you, just about a year ago, mid-March, you know, when stay-at-home orders, you know, went into place, we really needed to pivot our work. So, you know, the basis of our work is affordable housing, and I can talk about that and the huge needs for affordable housing. And Absolutely. We continue to drive toward producing more affordable housing, particularly in the state of California, because the needs are so great and the costs are so high for housing. But the other piece of it is really the services that we provide on property. And what we saw right away at the beginning of the pandemic was the need to be there for our residents, particularly our senior residents who were suddenly homebound. You know, they were at higher risk, they were scared, they didn't feel like they could go out and get groceries and such. And so we started doing door-to-door food delivery, partnering with local food banks to get that to them. We partnered with Amazon, where they donated a ton of product to get them basic needs. So that was basic hygiene, household cleaning products, toilet paper. I had several residents literally take a roll of toilet paper from me and say, this is like gold. Early in the pandemic, that was so valuable. And then started making wellness calls. So literally we had volunteers and staff just calling our seniors just to check in and say, hey, how are you doing? And we've continued to do those things throughout 2020. And it's continued to kind of evolve and pivot from there, which I could tell you a little bit more about.
Have you started to see people kind of shy away? You know, do they feel, all right, I helped last year with the homelessness, with food, with kind of basic necessities, I'm on to something else? Or are people still, you know, excited about helping you?
You know, it's an interesting question. I do think it's shifted. And I'll also say we've seen the needs shift. So okay. I was actually on one of our properties just yesterday, one of our senior properties. We were doing a food distribution. Initially, we were doing food distributions basically weekly, on a weekly basis. Now we're down to about once a month. And that's sufficient, you know, because initially, you know, those seniors... Absolutely. Yeah. You know, those seniors felt like they couldn't go to the grocery store. They weren't safe. Now they realize, you know what, I can safely once a week, you know, sneak out their senior hours at the grocery stores and get most of that. So the needs have shifted. The major need now that we're focusing on, and I'd say most of our institutional donors, I think we work with a lot of banks, financial institutions who support us. You know, their shift has been more toward the financial stability area. So many of our families have lost jobs. They've lost hours during this time. So they're struggling to pay their rent. They're racking up additional debt right now. And so we have a financial coaching program that we call Pathways to Economic Empowerment. And we've really been focusing on that. You know, one, doing some virtual kind of webinars and financial education with our residents. But secondly, offering one-on-one financial counseling to our residents to help them build a budget, figure out what their plan is during this period, helping them get back to work if they can. But we know that's slow because there's still a lot of jobs that haven't returned. And then secondly, helping them capture some of those federal dollars coming down for rental assistance, because that both helps our residents stay out of debt because that's paying rent that they owe essentially. And then us being an affordable housing landlord, if you will, that also helps us meet our bottom line to make sure we can continue to maintain our properties at the standards that we have at the same time. So that's a big focus. And like I said, I really think that's aligned with those institutional funders realizing right now housing retention is huge. So helping keep people in their housing.
How do people find you? Is it through a referral process with the state?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, from the housing standpoint, to find National Core, you know, each of our developments, you know, are typically built or acquired in partnership with the city. So most cities have a list of affordable housing. So we're on those lists. You're also probably familiar with 211, which is a great resource, 24/7, you know, free, you know, resource call center around the nation. And we're on all the 211 call lists as well. And so most residents, you know, they find us that way. Our waiting list, just to give you a sense, you know, we have about 85 communities throughout California, Florida, and Texas. But our typical wait time on the waiting list is about 2 to 5 years. So that shows you how much demand there is for, you know, the housing that we provide.
Is there, you know, maybe this is just maybe naive, but I think that there is this kind of stereotype of who takes advantage of affordable housing and food services. And that's not the case. You know, I've learned that throughout my career, that there is not one face that we can put on this. Is that true in California? Is that true nationally? Or am I just kind of making that up?
Yeah, you know, there's absolutely, let me say it this way. There's some similarities, but there are some differences as well. And there's definitely kind of a gamut in terms of those housing. I mean, the commonality is that they all have to meet income restrictions or have to.
All right. So there's an income threshold.
Typically, our residents have to earn between 30 to 60% of the area median income. And with that, then their rent is capped at about 30% of their income. So that means they're on the lower end of the spectrum in terms of their income coming in, but it fixes their rent at an affordable price. So all of our residents, it's long-term. They do pay rent because sometimes people have that misnomer that in affordable housing, you don't pay rent. You absolutely do.
Okay.
But it's fixed at about 30% of your income. And as your income increases, that rent increases as well until you reach a max.
All right. Do you have to ever have people, am I guaranteed that at least a rent in perpetuity, or is it once I hit a threshold, sorry, Dave, you know, you need to kind of, we've done our service to you.
Yeah, it's a longer conversation and actually a more complicated answer than you might think. So I won't dive into it too much. It is long-term affordable housing. And the intent is to provide that platform for families, which means essentially, and we want to empower them to increase their income and don't want to disincentivize them to increase their income. So the short answer is most of the time they can stay as long as they want to. We do have some properties that, and it depends on the funding sources that were used to build the properties. We primarily use tax credits, and there are some real strict requirements on tax credit properties. Right. There are some properties where those renters will move to what we call market rate units, which means their rent will increase to market rate. At that point, they could choose to move out. You know, one of the things, David, that we work on is when our residents reach those higher income levels, is rather than kicking them out, you know, instead using a carrot and helping them realize, hey, look, you could be a homeowner now. You don't need to be a renter. And you could actually be building long-term assets for your family and building generational, I'm going to call it wealth, but for these families, really building long-term stability. You know, the mission of the Hope Through Housing Foundation is to break the generational cycle of poverty. And we know home ownership is one of the greatest wealth-building assets across our country and has been historically. Mm-hmm. And many of the families who we work with have faced systemic and cultural and other barriers to becoming homeowners. And we realize that is, you know, something that we can help them to achieve.
It's a need that's not going to go away, even if COVID's not here, right?
So absolutely.
What has been your kind of biggest challenge in this odd year? Is it funding?
You know, it's a great question. You know, I would say It's been a challenge, but it's also been one that's been exciting as I think we have stepped up and paid attention to it. But I think it's relevance. And as I look at other organizations, it's relevance. It's the ability to pivot during this time and to adapt. You know, I read an article in Kiplinger's magazine, great, you know, personal finance magazine. And they talked about Mr. Kiplinger years ago. And one of his quotes, which I'm not going to get exactly right, was essentially, you know, in every period of time, you know, is a time of opportunity if you only know how to capture it. Mm-hmm. And just this reminder, even when we're in the worst of times, looking for where is the opportunity. And in our world, in the nonprofit world, and the mission, you know, kind of service world, I think that opportunity is looking at where is the need where we can pivot and address that need. So from my perspective, it has been, you know, maintaining relevance during this time, relevance to our residents and to those we're serving and supposed to be serving. And through that, I believe it also provides us relevance to our donors as well, where they see, okay, this organization shifted. It is a little bit different than what they were doing before, but the needs of
you adapt it, right? And your case for support, it's almost like there's now an invitation for you to seek funds, where if maybe housing or I don't want to say homelessness, because this is a different piece, but wasn't on my radar philanthropically. You know, I gave to my school or the food, even the food bank. This, you have an invitation to tell people why you're important and why their resources will go a long way, I think. Yes. And you talked about kind of institutional investors and banks and those kind of corporate donors. Can individuals still, and I know they probably can, but do individuals still support you? If we put a call of action out to anybody who's listening to this, kind of like, oh my goodness, this is something I want to get involved in. Are there opportunities for individuals?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, on both the institutional and individual side, you know, we rely on contributions, particularly on the service side. So not so much on the National Core Affordable Housing side. It's really to provide the services, which we know, you know, the housing provides the platform, but it's the resident services that really provide, you know, the opportunity for transformational change on our properties, you know, for our individual residents and for the community as a whole. And so, yes, absolutely. You know, we rely on donors to support our youth programs, which helps prepare youth for future self-sufficiency. Our Pathways program, helping, you know, provide economic mobility for our families. And then also just the basic health and wellness for our seniors. As well.
How, you know, there's always a challenge, any not-for-profit, of finding donors. You don't have a built-in kind of traditional alumni base, or how are you finding donors, and how do you tell this, you know, how do you get an opportunity to tell the story to new folks?
Yeah. So, you know, this is an interesting organization because we're an affordable houser, and we're actually the fifth largest developer, a nonprofit developer of affordable housing in the nation. That means we spend a lot of money on Absolutely, contractors yeah. and on vendors. And we realize that those vendors, one, are moved by our mission. Two, they want to keep our business. And so they're actually great prospects for us. And so we reach out to our vendors, inviting them to contribute on an annual basis. And there's no pressure, but they're absolutely encouraged to give at a regular basis. So we have an annual gala that we do that typically has, you know, 600-700 people in a ballroom. And I'll share this last year, you know, typically happens kind of end of the year, October, November. This last year, we really struggled with what do we do? Obviously, we can't put a couple hundred people in a ballroom. Do we lose this? You know, that's an event that the year prior raised about $700,000.
So that's income you need. Absolutely. Yeah,
it's real money for us. And so we shifted on that as well. And we went to a virtual event. We still ran the whole campaign just as if we were heading into a physical event with the sponsorship package, with an invitation, with donor sponsor levels, the whole thing. And then we did a one hour broadcast that was really tight, fast moving, all stories focused on our residents. And we ended up raising over $600,000. And quite honestly, David, because we didn't have the expenses of the in-person event, we actually netted just as much as we would have the prior year with an in-person event.
You know, we're hearing that nationally, right, with all sorts of not-for-profit organizations. So that's business is going to change even when we're out of this, the pandemic. I think, there'll be excitement to get together and have a drink and go to the gala. But at the same time, knowing that we don't have to necessarily invest in those kind of overt expenses, it's just going to help.
As a fundraiser, I do question, where is that going to go? You know, I mean, I love, in some ways, I love the virtual because it is less expensive. It's easier.
Right.
You can actually reach a broader audience geographically. But I do realize we are human beings and we like to be together and people value that contact, that, you know, physically being together, the networking, that kind of thing. So, you know, what we're looking at is, you know, hybrid models for later this year.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. Okay.
With the physical event.
Have you already booked those events?
We're working on that right now.
Fair enough.
We with everyone. I mean, fortunately, our big event happens in November, so we have a little bit of time.
A little bit of time, sure.
We have a group we call the Women of Hope, which is kind of our ladies philanthropy network. And we are working on an in-person event in July that will be outdoors. Where we feel pretty good about that. And so far we're hearing from our donors. They're interested and actually eager to get back together.
All right. What are any kind of words of wisdom, for maybe other organizations that are dealing with housing or, you know, basic social services? Maybe they're not as big or kind of as sophisticated a shop as you all. Any advice you can give your colleagues out there?
Yeah, you know, I mean, first on the housing side, we haven't talked a lot about the development of affordable housing. But what I'll tell you is we know that the needs far outweigh the available dollars for that. And most of the dollars, you know, are not philanthropic dollars. They're really, government, state, federal dollars coming down. And there are substantial dollars coming for the development of affordable housing, but it's nowhere close to, you know, meeting the needs. And there's a lot of reasons why affordable housing is very expensive. We probably have, you know, greater fees and more red tape than any other developer or builder out there, which means it actually makes it more expensive to produce affordable housing rather than less expensive. So one of those is, working with our legislators, you know, to advocate, you know, for those things, for, regulatory changes to make it more efficient for developers. The other thing that we're really looking at is working with, you know, private investors as well. You know, how do we create, you know, some tools for private institutional investors to make major contributions and still see some limited return on that? But for the purpose, you know, kind of mission driven, for the purpose of increasing affordable housing.
Do you partner with property owners? So if I had a duplex or a three family and I was so moved by your mission, are there ways for individuals to get involved that way?
You know, not right now. You know, most of our properties, they're larger. So typically they're 60 to 300 apartment units.
Typical
size. So in total, I mean, our portfolio, we have almost 9,000 apartment units. And so for us, it's more about economies of scale, right? But to your point, they're definitely, especially for smaller nonprofits, you know, running one and two, apartments. Actually, one of the first organizations I worked for, you know, we had a portfolio of maybe, I think it was 24 apartments, something like that. You know, and the work is different there. I mean, that was transitional housing and we went deep with those families and could really focus
on those
families. So, you know, I think there's a ton of value in that. I do think that there's some risk in the shift that's been made toward all kind of permanent housing and a shift away from short-term shelters and transitional housing, because the reality is there's always going to be a need for that. You know, those shorter-term programs for a family who's maybe, lost their footing and needs 6, 12, 18 months with intensive case management, counseling, employment guidance to get back on their feet and independent again in a short period of time, you know, that can help happen. So I really, you know, commend those organizations that continue to do that work despite the trend toward, sure, you know, just, you know, permanent.
I didn't realize that. That's a great kind of knowledge opener for me, in that we have a couple partners in tourist areas. I'm looking at Las Vegas and Boston. And in talking to your counterparts in these organizations, it's more transitional, I guess, because they've been pressing hotels. Hey, your capacity is at 15%, 20%. Let us take advantage of that. But there's been pushback. So I don't know.
Yeah. You know, we do have some projects here. There's actually in California and in the Los Angeles area, a project called Project Home Key, where we are converting hotels. So actually with the county of LA, we've recently acquired two motels that we're converting, and it'll essentially be transitional housing for the first 3 years, and then we'll be converted into long-term supportive housing.
All right.
There are some models for that, particularly if there's government funding behind it, where sure, it can work. And you know, that is focused specifically on previously chronic homeless individuals and their families. So all not right, just, you know, kind of low-income families, but those who are literally on the street.
And I think you mentioned it earlier, you're able to get some of the funding through like new market tax credits, or at least tax credits. Mm-hmm. So that's great.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We primarily, you know, rely on tax credits. It's the low income housing tax credit,
which
depending on what state you're in, it might be called something different, but essentially provides kind of the basic capital to build most of the properties. And then we also have some traditional debt and equity investment as well.
That's really good. Just a couple other questions. I know you're part of the core national group. Are you able to kind of leverage that partnership with folks in Florida and Texas for, you know, kind of more transformational giving from some of these national funders? Or is it really siloed as far as fundraising?
Yeah, you know, I wish the answer to that was yes, that we'd had success there. And there might be, so, you know, a couple challenges. You know, one is we are national core. We serve three states, which sometimes is difficult to make the case that we're truly national, right?
So those states are bigger than most countries anyway,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. So state, you're right. Florida, Texas, California, they're some of the largest states in the country. You know, so that's one challenge. Secondly, you know, a lot of the funders that we work with, they're still regionally focused. And even, I'll give an example, a bank, without naming that bank, because many operate this way, you know, they're obviously national and multinational. But when we talk with them, even if I just use Southern California as an example, and say, hey, look, yes, we're based in the Inland Empire. And by the way, for those who don't know Inland Empire, it's kind of like inland Southern California, you know, inland from Los Angeles, Orange County. Not as much income and not as much wealth here as on the coast. That means that there's also fewer philanthropic dollars in that region as well. Even those corporate funders allocate fewer dollars, because it's typically the banks typically allocate their community giving based on the amount of assets in that region. So you have fewer assets, you have less giving. Yeah. They also base their giving based on where the nonprofit is headquartered. So because we're headquartered in the Inland Empire, even though I'm serving Los Angeles, Orange County, and San Diego, the dollars that are contributed to my organization are typically from the Inland Empire pot of dollars.
Okay.
So that's one of our challenges on an ongoing basis, making that case where you realize we're not just an Inland Empire organization. You know, we actually have about 70 sites across Southern California, across all of these.
But
other
it doesn't areas. Matter, right? Plus, you could have 100 sites in Los Angeles County. It's not going to help you with the funding.
Yeah. So, so that's the conversation, and it depends on, you know, it depends on the institution. But many times the answer is, sorry, this is the way we've, you know, built our system, and it's going to be based on where you're headquartered.
All right.
So some would say we should just move our headquarters to Los Angeles, right?
Well, and you know, I was going to ask that.
Right. Where we're based.
I know. How did you end up in the Inland Empire as opposed to downtown LA or Los Angeles County or even Orange County, I guess?
Yeah, as an organization, our two founders, who are actually still part of our board of directors, they both were from the Inland Empire area, one in particular, and this is where their roots were. They started it here, and the organization's kind of grown organically from here.
Yeah, so if you look, absolutely.
Yeah, if you look at the footprint of our apartment units, it also kind of just, you know,
expanded from there
out from the Inland Empire. Yeah.
All right. What, we've talked a little bit about funding. are there opportunities for volunteering with you all? Do you need volunteers?
Yes, we absolutely, you know, love using volunteers. I will say the last year has been challenging because, you know, in this era of social distancing, bringing additional people on site or near our residents is not necessarily, you know, popular thing. So we have created some, you know, on a limited basis, some virtual opportunities. I'm definitely seeing our corporate partners asking for virtual opportunities. So one of those for us are wellness calls. So giving them the ability to make phone calls out to our seniors, where it's really just simply checking in. Hey, how are you doing? You know,
and I bet that call goes a long way. I bet they
absolutely. Yeah. You know what? And we didn't know how those would go initially. And what we found is that our residents simply value having somebody, you know, having a warm voice on the other end of the line and just having somebody reach out. Right. So we've used people that way. Also use volunteers for food distribution on our sites. I was actually out yesterday on a property helping our team distribute food out door to door, you know, and just seeing our residents' faces, how grateful they are. We recently did a survey of our seniors, and the comments in there, one of the things we asked is what more would you like to see? And it was really encouraging seeing the comments, which were, you're always there for me. You answer any questions I have. You meet my needs. You've been there for me this last year. So really rewarding. So back to your volunteer question, use volunteers in that way. We're also moving back toward engaging volunteers in our youth programs. So we do have after school programs where we like to bring in business professionals from the community to share their stories. We call them career conversations, but essentially to open our kids' eyes to the different careers that are out there and the educational path that's required to get you to those types of careers. So these kids start to go, okay, that means I need to take school seriously today. And here's the path I'm going to need to take in order to get there.
One last question, and this was kind of, I've been thinking about it. Do you ever have an opportunity to kind of highlight someone who has gone through your programs and is just so successful that almost like an alum, like a superstar alum if you were at a school? Because it seems like you're doing some pretty amazing things and you have some pretty amazing programs.
Yeah, you know, usually when that happens, and I would say this is an area where we could probably do more of that. Usually where that happens is when we're looking, you know, to put together either, you know, an event where we have a speaker there, or if we're putting together in a video, you know, highlighting what we're doing, we usually look for those stories. And I'll tell you those stories, you know, one recently was a young man who grew up on our property. His mom, you know, single mom. And I'll tell you, the majority of our residents are single mom with a couple kids, just trying to put food on the table. Single mom. You know, he became part of our after school program, and through the after school program had just, you know, right on site in our community centers, had a place he could go every day, got homework help, got the support he needed, you know, stayed on track. Long story short, not only the first in his family to go off to college, but he went off to the University of Notre Dame, and just great, successful, you know, successful.
Absolutely. All right.
We have a lot of kids who that's their story. They're first generation, first in their family. And like I said, that's our goal, is to break that generational cycle of poverty. And we know that that's a big step in that direction.
Any parting shots for me? I appreciate your time this morning. This is pretty good stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, we could keep talking, obviously. There's a lot of, it's a very interesting kind of arena that we work in, because it is a combination of social services and affordable housing. And then there's the whole public side of it, which, you know, I love as well. You know, the, you know,
kind of unique others. Compared to any other organization. I'm trying to figure out is there a benchmark? Is there another organization that does anything sort of like you?
You know, I've learned there are other organizations across the country, but they're, you know, I'd say in the state of California, there are maybe, you know, five or six other players similar to us. And across the country, you know, there's some big ones on the East Coast and then not a lot in between. So obviously, you know, you have a lot of small nonprofits who are, like I said, running kind of shelters and transitional housing programs. And then
more on the social service side.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the difference here is, I mean, I work in a nonprofit real estate development company, essentially, that's mission focused. And, you know, one of the things we say, and this kind of came from our founders because they were businessmen, is business mind, mission heart.
All right.
So
that's it.
Thinking operating like a business. If you look at, you know, our office that I'm sitting in, very corporate, but it's all mission oriented.
Right.
And by the way, that's my job. I mean, as the senior vice president of social impact, is to make sure that we stay focused on the social impact.
All right. Well, you keep doing it. Stop talking to me and get out there. Unfortunately, I've had to say this for the past year. I've met a lot of amazing people through this, and I never get to see them in person. I'm hoping I'm back out in Southern California in the next 4 or 5 months, and would love to come visit and see what you all are doing.
Yeah, look me up.
Greg, thank you. And be safe, stay well, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, stay warm out there. Take care, David.
Thanks, Greg. Bye-bye.